Today is Sunday, May 24th, 2020. This is a part three Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Esther Litton, Esther Litton. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Esther. How are you?
Good afternoon. I'm just fine.
Wonderful. May I have your permission to record this this interview?
Yes.
Thank
yes, you. You do.
You know, you told us some really great stories from the winter, fall, winter, and spring of 1944, or 1943, 1944 in Florida. Is there anything else you'd like to recount about that time?
Yes. At that time, I met a young woman who lived in the same apartment building, and we decided to go to an afternoon movie. They were showing For Whom the Bell Tolls. It was not a very fancy theater. It was a neighborhood theater. And as we approached it, we saw that the side wall was painted white. And there was a stairway going up to the second floor. And in black letters across the above the stairway, it said, colored only.
Wow.
And that was a shock for me. I'd never seen that particular thing happen. But as we approached to get our tickets, there was a drinking fountain which said whites only.
Wow.
So anyway, we did see, but that was an occurrence that was very unusual and a teaching moment for me.
Right. Coming from California, I would imagine.
Yes.
I had a question for you. You mentioned in the last interview a couple of times about some rowboats on a river.
And yes. Flowing into Tampa Bay was the Hillsborough River.
Okay.
And we had enough gas to wander up the river to a place where there were a couple of rowboats tied up. They didn't seem to belong to anybody, and there was no dock. They were just tied up on the edge of the bank, and it had the oars in it, so we borrowed the boat and rowed down the river, the Hillsborough River, not just once, but we did it a couple of times. And it was a lovely pastoral kind of scene. And in the water, I noticed a fish I'd never seen before and never seen since. It was a gar. It was a long-nosed gar.
Wow.
It was a long fish, about maybe it could be 2 or 3 feet long. And it swam close to the surface. But also I noticed trees that were unusual for me, and they were growing wild. There was the liquid amber, and there were willows. The thing with the liquid amber, I had never noticed a tree whose leaves would turn from green to yellow to purple. And also on some of the logs in the river were turtles that would jump off as we approached.
And I was curious, was this your first experience with a rowboat? You had mentioned a canoe on the Russian River.
Oh, yes, it was my first experience with a rowboat. I'd only done the canoe on the Russian River.
Okay.
But Martin was very adept with a rowboat.
Okay.
Had
he rowed in a boat before?
Oh, yes. He was on the varsity crew. He was on the crew at UCLA from the time he was a freshman to the time he graduated. He was a senior, and at the end, he was the stroke on the varsity crew.
You had mentioned that, and I had, of course, I was curious, though, before college, had he spent time swimming and boating?
I don't know anything about that.
Okay.
Just know that he'd done a lot of hiking in the Sierra Nevada, but I wasn't aware of any rowboat experience.
Okay, all right. Were there any other things that you can remember from Florida, from, the cultural differences that really took you aback?
Yes. No, I think I have mentioned before, yesterday, other events and things that surprised me about Florida. There was one thing that in hiking I had to be careful because there was a poison sumac. We didn't come in contact with poison ivy, but I did come in contact with poison sumac, which acts very much like poison ivy, and it was very uncomfortable.
I bet. Wow. And then in the spring of 1944, the glider pilots got called out.
Yes, they were all called in to report to Bowman Field in Kentucky. So in March, we packed up our suitcase and put it in the back seat. That was all we had, very little. And we made our way from Florida up through Georgia and North Carolina, South Carolina, Kentucky, and up to Bowman Field, where Martin reported in and requested time to drive his wife to a point where she could go back to California. So he was granted, I think it was 10 days anyway, it was enough that we drove down to Albuquerque, and my aunt came on the train to join me to drive the car back to California, because Martin wouldn't have any use for the car after that.
Right.
And I assume that he took the train to go back to Bowman Field, Kentucky.
Okay. Can you follow his story forward until you saw him again?
Yes. The glider pilots were shipped out almost immediately, and they went on the Louis Pasteur ship, which the stabilizer had been removed so it wouldn't, so that submarines wouldn't spot it. And in the rough sea, he said that in the dining room, the chairs and tables would slide from one place, one side to the other.
Wow.
And when they reached Great Britain, he was assigned to Cottesmore Airfield, which was in the state or province of England called Rutland, which is the smallest. I'm not sure how they designate the areas, whether they're provinces or states or what, but it was the smallest one. And it was near a village of Cottesmore. And while they were there, they prepared, this was April maybe of 44, and I think the invasion took place in June. They didn't use the gliders to go in for the invasion for D-Day, but they did schedule them for September for for the Market Garden invasion, which was to be the invasion of Holland, which it was in German hands at that time. It was dramatized in a book by Cornelius Ryan called The Bridge Too Far. The aim was to capture these three bridges, the Eindhoven, the Nijmegen, and the Arnhem, before the Germans could destroy them. And the gliders were used to bring in the troops to various parts, fields in Holland, to bring in infantry, and each glider would hold about 20 troops with their backpacks. And Martin took a lot of pictures at the time of the getting the tow planes together and the ropes. Each tow plane, I don't remember if it was a B-17 or what denomination the plane was, but each plane would tow two gliders. So they had these long, long ropes going from the plane to the glider. And they took off, I don't remember what day it was, but it was early September. And these hundreds and hundreds of gliders, not just from Cottesmore, but I think other fields that had gliders, because they had hundreds and hundreds of gliders stationed in England. So when they took off, the directions were detach your glider when you see the pink smoke. So Martin realized he was in trouble. because not only when they got over the channel was it a very foggy day, but it was also, he couldn't tell if it was pink smoke or gray smoke or what, and he realized that where he was to land, he'd be in trouble if he landed in the wrong place. So the only way to get word to the glider beside him was to radio. There was a radio line to the pilot of the airplane, of the B-17, to tell him to communicate with the pilot of the other glider and tell him to be the first to cut off, because Martin was supposed to be the first to cut off. And the other glider pilot didn't like that very much and cursed Martin for that. But at least when they got over home, they cut off at the right place. And he landed safely. It was an open field, which my younger son visited many years later.
Wow.
And it's still there. And there's a small museum dedicated to the gliders who landed in that particular field. And they were fortunate in the field where they landed, because aerial photography was not very good at the time, and whatever aerial photography they had of Holland Fields didn't give much in the way of details of what was on the ground. And some of the fields that the gliders landed in had been vineyards, and the vineyards were very old, and they just showed up as dark spots on the photograph. So many of the gliders were damaged and smashed to smithereens when they landed on the field with the vineyards.
Right.
But Martin was very fortunate. They landed, and he took pictures of where they were landing, and when the infantry took off, and they went marching off, and then he was to get back to Brussels. He was to make his way from there to Brussels. So he hitched a ride with a truck that was passing by. It was a Negro driver who was lost. He was supposed to go to Chartres, France, but he didn't know where he was. And so Martin said, well, you're going to Belgium now. And they got in the truck and they drove, but they had to stop frequently because the radiator had been pierced by bullets and it kept leaking. So they had to stop every once in a while, and there was a ditch where Martin said he got the water. Anyway, he got to Brussels, and from Brussels at an airfield, he got transportation back to England. And his next assignment was in December during the Battle of the Bulge, when the troops were caught in the Ardennes Forest. And they used the gliders to come into an airfield and pick up the wounded. In the meantime, they had figured out a way to pick up the gliders, and it involved a goal post in football where you have the two posts and a post in between.
Yeah.
And I won't try to explain it because I don't understand it myself. But they had figured out a way to pick up the gliders. So Martin made one trip across the channel to this airfield to pick up the wounded who could be saved at that time. And the glider contained a doctor and a nurse, and they loaded the wounded and returned them to England. And after that, I don't remember that he had any glider assignment, because the war, well, finally, we did get out of the Battle of the Bulge, and gradually the Germans were defeated, and I forget when, in 45, the war was over in Europe. But I think it was in April or May that the war was over. And so Martin made his way home, flew home, and he arrived around September. I'm all wrong here. No, he was dismissed for a month, and only a month, because the invasion of Japan was planned, And I don't know why they were thinking of using gliders. I can't imagine. But anyway, as a glider pilot, he was told to report for duty again in a month. And so when he came home, he had that time off, and he wanted to go on a pack trip into the Sierra, which we did. He had brought home a mummy bag from the army and a pup tent, and he knew what to do as far as camping. At that time, freeze-dried foods were beginning to be available, so he had done the packing for the food and the sleeping bags, and we went in to the Sierra on the east side to a place called North Lake. And from there we went over, I think it was Army Pass, down into Humphreys Basin at the foot of Mount Humphreys. Now, I had never done anything like that. I had never been in a sleeping bag. I had never slept in the ground. And this was all completely new territory for me. But it turned out beautifully. I really enjoyed it. I actually enjoyed sleeping on the ground. I didn't necessarily enjoy washing clothes in the cold stream.
Uh-huh.
But Martin had the itinerary all worked out. And we went over the John Muir Pass into Evolution Valley. And at the time, for a long time, I could remember almost every step we took, but I can't remember now.
Hmm.
But we did make our way into Evolution Valley, and we were camped at a lake called McClure Lake. The only other people we had come in contact in the mountains was a lady who looked like she was a grandma. She had a burro and two little kids with her. So she was obviously taking them up there into the mountains for the summer for a vacation. But along with her, not the same day, but a pack train came by where the packer was taking his horses up to the meadow for the summer. So he stopped to say hello, and he said, you know, the war is over. They dropped the atom bomb. Well, the atom bomb didn't mean much, and visually we couldn't see it. We couldn't imagine what it looked like or what harm it did, you know, but the war was over. So we finished our trip, and of course then we didn't need the gas coupons or anything. And the big shock of the trip was we hadn't seen any people except this packer and the other lady. And as we came down into South Lake, there was noise because there were people camped there, and it was a shock to hear all these people talking. Anyway, we made it home, and he reported to Santa Ana, a base in Santa Ana, which is in Southern California. And I went with him, and I stayed in the barracks with other ladies. And he was dismissed from the Air Force, and this was September of 1945, and then, of course, we learned of the chaos that had happened in Japan, the atom bomb and the effect of the atom bomb. But at the time, we had no impression of the devastation and how it had ended.
Hmm.
So,
Esther, can you now back up to when Martin left you in Albuquerque? And you had the car and your aunt.
Yeah.
And then tell what happened while Martin was doing all that. What did you do?
Well, my aunt and I drove home to Los Angeles, to California. I didn't want to drive alone, and she came out on the train to Albuquerque and joined me, and we drove the car, the Chevrolet, back to California.
Then did you look for work, or what did you do?
Oh, well, no, wait a minute, no. When I got home, nobody had told me how ill my grandmother was. She had breast cancer, and it had metastasized. And my aunt and her son, years before, had come to live with us when her marriage failed.
Okay.
And she lived right next door, just a driveway away next door. And when she came to live with us, my mother incorporated her into the work at the studio because she knew how to do the work that was required. So she had a little income, and she lived in this duplex next door. But she had taken time off now because my grandmother was so ill, and she was taking care of my grandmother. And so when I got home, I was essentially there helping take care of my grandmother, and she passed away soon after that. I don't remember whether it was 44 or 45, but she passed away at that time.
Okay.
And then afterwards, before Martin came home, during the time that he was away, I was just keeping the house for my mother, and my aunt was working with my mother, and I was taking care of my grandfather, who was quite frail. And so that was how I spent my time until Martin came back.
Okay.
And, of course, at that time, we thought the war was still going to go on into Japan,
right,
as I described.
Right. Okay, so what gave Martin, or you and Martin, the idea to take the pack trip into the Sierras?
Well, that was his idea because he loved the Sierra, and he had that whole month off, and so he planned to go back to places that he had enjoyed and introduce me to the Sierra.
Nice.
Yeah, so that was his idea. But then when we got out, the war was over. And in September, when he was released from the service, we went to live with my mother. But before we settled down with my mother, we drove back to Monument Valley. And at that time, Monument Valley had changed as far as people were concerned, because when we got to Goldings, there were other guests there, and they were mostly men who were geologists, and they had discovered uranium somewhere in the area,
okay,
and they were there prospecting for the uranium. But we stayed in Goldings, I think, just one night or two nights, and then we took off to some of the other Navajo villages, areas. I can remember Ganado, the town of Ganado.
Okay.
Which has a hospital.
Yes.
And outside the door of the hospital was a sign that said, "Tradition is the enemy of progress."
Wow.
And there was a Navajo woman in her Navajo clothes pushing a stroller with a baby who was holding an Even Flow bottle. At that time, Even Flow was the milk, was the bottle that held milk at the time.
Wow.
And so anyway, I was always impressed by that sign, because many of the traditions of the Navajo were hard on their health, especially childbearing. It was very primitive. And, of course, there could be much infection, and the children didn't live. Many didn't survive the first year.
Right.
So it was a difficult time for them.
Yes.
But we went on to Window Rock, and then I think that was when we went to Canyon de Chelly.
Okay.
Have you ever been to Canyon de Chelly?
Yes, gorgeous.
Yes. Well, at the time, there was nobody around.
Wow.
There were no regulations. There was no, I think there was some building that's for the headquarters of Canyon de Chelly.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody stopped us, so it prevented us from driving into the canyon. And Martin had his camera, and I think one of the first things we came to was the White House, the ruin in Canyon de Chelly, and he took a picture of that. And we went, I don't know whether Mummy Cave is before the Canyon of the Dead, but we did get as far as we could, and it was either Mummy Cave or the Canyon of the Dead, because we went into both of those canyons. And Martin took some pictures in Mummy Cave. Have you been to Mummy Cave?
I haven't.
No. Well, it's like two caves with a solid piece in between, and that solid piece is a remnant of an ancient village, an ancient village, a place to live anyway.
Hmm.
It's very large. It's a beautiful, beautiful place.
Wow.
And very, very big right in between. And I remember I climbed up to it, and Martin took a picture, but you can hardly find me because it was to get the whole building in. Anyway, I'm in it, a little black spot at the bottom.
Okay.
Canyon de Muerto is a very sad area. It's a V-shaped canyon with one wall facing the other wall, and the Spaniards had chased the Navajo from on top on the mesa to the point where the Navajo, the men and the women, old men and women, made their way in. They had a way to get into the cave from above.
Mm.
But opposite that cave was the mesa where the Spaniards from that point could shoot them. And they did. They shot them all, killed them all, all right. The people who were in the opposite cave. So it's called the Cañon de Muerto, the Canyon of the Dead.
Yes.
But if that was the last place we reached, that was as far as we went, because we did just come to those two places. And we almost got stuck in the sand because it was just a sandy bottom of the canyon. And I remember that Martin took some other pictures along the way. But then we came home. And Martin, at that time, when we got back, it might not have been December. I don't know whether he started back at Los Angeles Times in December. But when he did go back, they were very good about making room for the veterans who had worked there, and they wanted to find a place for them.
Hmm.
So they offered him a job in the color lab, but he told them that he wouldn't be any use there because he was colorblind. So they put him in the circulation department. But coming back to the colorblindness thing, because when we were dating, we were in the mountains and he wanted to get a picture of the snow plant. I don't know if you're familiar with the snow plant.
No.
But it's a saprophytic flower. It has no chlorophyll. And it's one of the first things that comes up in the snow. And it's bright red.
Hmm.
And it comes up to about 12 inches. And it has a fleshy stalk from which there are little red bells.
Oh.
And it's all very fleshy. And Martin wanted to get a picture of the snow plant when it came up. So he said, tell me when you see one.
Okay.
Well, he had just gone past one that was bright red. And he hadn't noticed it. So I told him it was there, and he took the picture of it. But anyway, to come back to the Times, in the circulation department, he was what was called a roadman. And he would be assigned 1 week to the city circulation, where he would meet with the dealers and the paper boys, be sure that they were getting their papers on time. Then he would be shifted to the suburban, which was out in outer areas, and the same thing. Sometimes he had to start early in the morning, about 3 a.m, to be sure that they got their papers on time.
Hmm.
Then he was assigned to the country, and the country involved going into Owens Valley north, and then up into, and then on the coast side to Santa Barbara. So it was quite a large area.
Huge.
He would be gone for about a week. He wouldn't cover it all at one time because the assignments were, you know, you did this particular group of the city, suburban, and country, and then you'd come back to city, suburban, and country.
Hmm.
But at different times, he was in these different areas. And as he wandered around, well, I should explain that when we were living with my mother in 46, in June of 46, I had my son. And and we were still living with my mother. But while we were living with my mother, we also went to a night class in Los Angeles, which offered the ability to design your home. An architect was teaching this class, and he could help you design your home if you wanted. There was a lot of remodeling of garages at the time, turning them into apartments and that. So it was a well-attended class. And while my mother took care of John, the baby, we would go, I don't know whether it was once a week or how many times we went, but Martin had had drafting in high school, and we had the property. We had purchased the property in Brentwood, so we had a location for a house. And during the war, Martin had sent home sketches of what he thought the house should look like. So we took this class, and the architect, Frederick Bonhoeff, I remember, helped Martin and the rest of the students design whatever they wanted, you know, a house or an apartment or whatever. So Martin designed the house, made the plans for the house, and the architect drew the picture of how the house would look, because we had to have a picture for the real estate company. And for the loan. So I think we may have been the only ones in the class who actually built the house that we designed.
Nice.
Because while Martin was in the circulation department with these changes of area, he often had time in the afternoon. And we got a contractor who was willing to have Martin come and help whenever he could. And at one point, we were on the roof nailing the shingles. So we got the GI loan, which was 2%. We had saved $5,000 before the loan, which was for $10,000. So with the $15,000, we built the house. And we had designed a two, it was an ample house. It was really, but it only had, what we finished was two bedrooms, one bath, a large living room and dining room area, and a nice kitchen. And in the service porch, which was quite large, Martin had his dark room. He designed his dark room. And there was a slightly lower level to the garage, and over the garage, which was attached to the house, we put in the just the bare minimum of space for two more bedrooms and one bath. None of that area was finished, so that was left for the future. But with his dark room, he was able to print and work on the photography he was doing, because as he roamed around these different areas in Los Angeles and outside, he saw the chances for stories. He loved steam engines, and every once in a while there'd be a rail fan trip, which we would go on, and he would photograph it and write about it, and it would be printed. And he'd get a few dollars for the story, and he'd get the credit. And then he'd, at the same time, in October of 1951, well, I have to go back because my daughter was born in February of 49.
Okay, so hang on a second. Let's go back to June of 1946, when your son John was born. Is that right? And where did you pick the name John?
I don't remember.
Okay.
I think maybe it was his family. It was a family name of his. I don't know.
Okay.
It was Juan. It would be Juan in Spanish, although my grandfather was Jose, so it wasn't a family name. I don't know. It was John Christopher Litton.
Okay. Okay.
Christopher was his grandfather's name, but I don't know where we got the John.
Huh. All right. And you know, your mom had such a difficult pregnancy. Were you worried with your firstborn about how that would go?
Well, that was interesting because the doctor that I had was fairly far into Los Angeles. And so the hospital I was to attend to go to was quite a distance from our home in Culver City. So when I was ready to deliver, there was no room at the big hospital, and so I was told to report to a small neighborhood hospital, which was down in Washington Boulevard. It was called the Washington Hospital. It was just a one-story building, living in its facilities. And that was where I went to have John. And I did not, fortunately, have the problem my mother had. So the birth was okay. But there was no room in any of the beds, you know, the areas for the beds. I was out in the hall and with a curtain around me.
Wow.
And at that time, which was 1946, childbirth required you to stay in the hospital for at least 10 days.
Wow, yes.
Yeah, and you were not to get up on all those 10 days. You did not walk around at all. Which at the end of the time when you finally got up, you were very weak.
Yeah.
And it took longer to get over the childbirth than today, you know. But at that time, it was that was what was done. But it turned out all right. I did not have the experience my mother had.
Great. Okay. So just trying to watch the timeline here. In the fall of 46, Martin's working for the Times.
Yes.
And when did you guys start building on the house?
Well, we started building soon after we had the plans. We had it. It was finished in 1948 because that was when we moved into the house, and Kathleen was born in 49. When we were actually in the house that we built.
Okay. So there was
We lived in that house from 48 to 1954.
Okay. All right. You know, you took a pretty big trip to Monument Valley and over to Canyon de Chelly. Did you take any other big trips like that in 49 or 48?
No, we didn't. We actually didn't go anywhere until, Martin was doing quite a few little articles about different things. And one of the articles that he did, because he heard about Dinosaur National Monument,
right,
through the National Parks Association, and I think he heard about that saw it in the brochure in 1950. So in 1951, in October of 1951, Kathleen was just two, or she would be almost three in the next year, but she was two. And John was almost five. And for his vacation, which he took that year in October, we drove to Utah and stopped in at the headquarters of Dinosaur National Monument, which is in Vernal, Utah.
Yep.
And that's the place where they have the wall, the dirt where they're digging. But the monument itself has thousands of wild country, thousands of miles, acres of wild country canyons.
Yeah, yeah.
The Green and the Yampa come together at the Echo Park.
Yes.
And so we found out how to get into the Mantle Ranch, of which we had seen photographs. But Phil Hyde, the photographer, had been there the year before.
Okay.
And had taken pictures. So we wandered down these sandy roads into Echo Park, and it was fall color, and the huge cottonwoods were yellow.
Oh, my.
It was beautiful. And Martin had color camera then, and he took some color pictures, which were used later. But then from Echo Park, we had to go back out It was up and down, and up high and then down low. We found our way down to the Mantle Ranch, which was on the Yampa River.
Mm-hmm.
It was completely isolated, all by itself. And they were cut off during the winter time. They had no way out. But the Mantle family lived in a log house, which was quite spacious and very, very nice. And we approached it to get permission to camp on the property. Mrs. Mantle was alone at the time, and she said her menfolk were away doing something, and we didn't need to camp. Just come on in and stay with her.
Oh, gosh.
So we did. She was cooking on a wood stove, so she gave us our dinner. She had just baked a pear pie. She had venison. She had potatoes. She had tomatoes. She had all kinds of vegetables from her garden, and she fed us. And then from there, Martin took some pictures. We wandered up on top on the plateau, where she said there was a former sheep herder's cabin. It was just a one room cabin, and just very small, with just one bed, and where we stayed for the night. And from there, Martin took some pictures down into the canyon. But there were different areas on a higher elevation that we wandered around, and Martin could take pictures looking down into the canyon. And he got, and on our way out, we went through Split Mountain to another farm, a ranch that was there more in the flat country, not cut off the way the Mantle Ranch was.
Uh-huh.
On the Yampa River. And that was Mr. Evans, who had a home there. I don't know what he raised, but they were all, the Mantle people and the Evans people were not looking forward to the dams, but they figured it was a foregone conclusion that it was going to happen.
Mm.
So they were amused that we were fighting it, and they wondered how successful that would be. And after World War II, before World War II, there had been a lot of building of dams. There were two big dams built in Washington State, and Hoover, during his administration, had started in Boulder Canyon what was called the Hoover Dam,
right,
which is now called Boulder Dam. So after the war, the Department of Interior was gung-ho to build more dams. So they looked at a lot of rivers, and they figured they could dam them here and dam them there. And so they had plans for the two dams in the Grand Canyon, and three dams in Dinosaur, and the Grand Canyon Dam. And they were just having a great time planning all these dams. So the reason that we went, because Martin had made some contact at that time with the Sierra Club and David Brower.
Okay.
So we got pictures of what there was there, what would be destroyed. And in 1953, Martin had persuaded the Sierra Club to schedule a river trip. By that time, I think they had defeated the idea of the dams and Dinosaur, but they did want to introduce members of the Sierra Club and the board of directors to what it was they had tried to save. So this first river trip of many that the Sierra Club later scheduled on different rivers, not just Dinosaur, but they started with Dinosaur. So they had gotten the bridge pontoon, for one thing, which held about 10 people.
Mm-hmm.
And they had another smaller rubber raft, a big raft from Army surplus that they used. And Martin had been asked to pick up a raft from somebody in Tucson who wanted to send it to Bus Hatch in Vernal.
Okay.
So we took along this raft that joined the pontoon and the other rafts and went along with a Sierra Club trip in 1953.
So let's back up a little bit. to the first time you were there, I think in 50 or 51, October of 51, maybe. I'm
October
not...
51, yes.
Okay. Do you remember the superintendent there, a guy named Jess Lombard?
Yes, yes.
What can you tell me about Jess?
Well, just that we met him, and he said, you know, we've got room in the hospital if you want to stay there tonight instead of camping out on a motel.
Okay.
And he gave us some food, and yes, we did meet him. And I think we met him later in another park. But yes, I do. I had forgotten his name until you just said it. Yes, yes, Lombard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Kind of tall, thin guy, and good-natured. Yeah. So that there was a really nice article that came out of that October trip that you were on.
Yes.
And I was really curious. Martin seemed very eloquent and very well versed in the
content. Have you read that article?
I did.
In the Times?
Yeah. He was very, very well versed and articulate in describing the qualities of wilderness.
Yeah.
And I wondered, you know, how did he get to that realization? Do you know?
Well, as a teenager, he was always conservation-minded. He was always afraid roads were going to be built here and there, and he was an English major in college. That was his major. And he knew enough about geology because one of his very good friends in college was a geology major and took Martin along when he had to do his senior thesis of the geology of Newport Bay. And so Martin was aware of much of geology, but he knew how to write very well.
Well, it's interesting. You mentioned the sign there at Ganado about tradition and progress,
yes.
and yet wilderness is about preserving landscapes. I mean, uh-huh. Large areas.
Well, he didn't care about the people.
Right. You know, but you know, the sort of progress would be, well, we want to go into these big landscapes and build dams and all kinds mm-hmm. of, you know, log and mine and things. So I just think it's really, really neat that even with progress, you and Martin had a vision of...
Yeah.
Of
when he was a teenager, when he was about 17 or 18, he used to write letters to the newspaper because there was a road that was planned over the Angeles, over the mountains from Los Angeles over to the other side, which would be, pretty close to where we live now.
Okay.
And it was this tremendous project, and he objected to that because on their Sunday drives, he always enjoyed the fact that they went out into the countryside. So he wanted to keep the things the way they were as he was seeing them. And he objected to the idea of roads going into the wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote letters to the Los Angeles, to the papers, objecting and voicing his objections of what the road would destroy. So he'd been doing that since he was a teenager.
Okay, all right. And the Echo Park dam fight was amazing because it brought people, conservation community, all across the country. You mentioned the National Parks Association, Sierra Club, the Isaac Walton League, the Wilderness Society, and all kinds of church groups and garden clubs across the country, really, really becoming aware of wanting to preserve our national parks. At the same time...
that it was a national monument.
Right.
And that was the only hook they had. With Glen Canyon, they had no hook. It was lost, and David Brower always lamented that. But then, of course, when you get to Glen Canyon, that was approaching, well, I'm getting off the track.
Yeah, we're jumping ahead a little bit, and we'll get there, but let's explore this just a little bit, because it seems that you're exactly right. the National Park Service, with its parks and monuments, could be at risk by the Bureau of Reclamation. But Glen Canyon, the Reclamation Service had fought the Park Service very tooth and nail to keep the Park Service out of Glen Canyon, and that happened in the 30s. Was there a sense in the early 50s that fight had happened and Glen Canyon just had to be sacrificed, or did nobody realize quite yet that Glen Canyon was amazing and needed to be preserved, but there wasn't a hook to preserve it yet?
Right. No, it was known, because there was a man named Doc Holliday in either Salt Lake City or somewhere up there who fought hard to keep it free of the dam, and Dave Brower also fought hard, to keep it out, keep the dam out. But as you say, there was no official designation of Glen Canyon. There were river trips going down Glen Canyon.
Oh yeah,
people
lots
taking pictures, but there was no official designation, so there was nothing to hang on to.
Okay,
and so they sacrificed Glen Canyon. And had to let Page, the dam at Page, Glen Canyon Dam, go in.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's funny because the Wilderness Act, by Senator Saylor, John Saylor, I don't know if that name rings a bell. Basically said 5,000 acres. Doesn't matter who the overseeing agency is, if it has wilderness qualities, it can go into this preservation system.
Yes.
And I wondered, and trying to research this out, whether
yes.
whether the Wilderness Act itself was an offshoot of the realization that Glen Canyon Dam needed, or Glen Canyon,
yeah.
needed to be protected.
Well, I don't remember the dates. I don't remember the sequence. And I've forgotten a lot I knew at the time it was all happening, but I've lost track of the years and the sequence of these events.
Okay.
I'm sorry about
No, that. No worries. Well, all right. So this is October of 51. You guys went out to Dinosaur. Was that a fun trip? Did you enjoy that?
Oh, yes. Very much. Yeah. It was beautiful country, and meeting Mrs. Mantle, her hospitality and the area was so beautiful.
Nice.
And so dramatic. And it was kind of up and down one sandy road to another. It was difficult country to get over, but it was really very exciting and very beautiful. And we were very fortunate in the weather. We didn't have any storms. We had no rain, no problems as far as that was concerned. But the hospitality of this woman all by herself, taking us in and feeding us and sending us on our way.
Nice. And then you came back, and were you on that river trip in 1953?
Yes, we were. And that was we stopped at the Mantle Ranch at that time. And Charlie Mantle was home at that time. He came out. We were camped under the orchard trees. They had an apple orchard. And we were all camped under the trees. And he came out to greet us. And he said, "Don't throw away your cans, tin cans. We use those for cups."
Oh, okay.
and at that time, he and his sons were harvesting the hay and digging up the potatoes and I don't know what all they were doing, but we did meet Charlie Mantle at that time, and we also met one of the sons, I believe.
Okay.
Because Martin took some more pictures up on top and along the river.
Do you remember who else was on that river trip?
Yes, I do. Francis Farquhar, who was president of the Sierra Club at the time, and Marjorie Farquhar, his wife.
Okay, wait, stop, right? Stop right there. can you tell me about Francis and Marjorie and how you first met them?
Well, we first met them on the river. We were right there, camp, getting ready to start the trip, and Martin blew up the rubber raft and and said, well, we have our own food. And Marjorie came over and says, well, that's silly. She said, we've got a cook here. We've got food. If you don't mind joining your food with ours, come on over and eat with us.
Well, that's nice.
So we came together, and she was very, very kind about that. But in addition, Bester Robinson was along. He was on the board of directors, and his wife was along. They had brought some what was called fold boats, and they were kind of the pre-kayaks.
Yeah, okay.
They were just cloth, and they used their little fold boats at times.
So
I can't remember the names, but they were board members at that time on that year who were along. And at the end of the trip, two of the board members wanted to run the green because Powell had come through on the green and had some trouble in one of the rapids. And two of the board members wanted to run the green. So Martin left the kids and me at a motel in Vernal, and then he and these two other board members ran the green.
Oh, down through Lodore.
Yeah.
Okay, so you guys had gone down the Yampa and down through Split Mountain.
Yeah, but these people wanted to kind of reproduce where Powell had gone.
Okay.
And so Martin, I don't know where they got the boat, but anyway, they had a small raft, and they made it through the green.
Nice.
And then he came and picked us up.
So, Esther, Francis and Marjorie Farquhar had boated Grand Canyon from Lee's Ferry to Phantom Ranch in 1948.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Bester was... Exactly. And Bester Robinson was on that trip as well. And then in 49, Robinson ran with Ed Hudson through the Grand Canyon. So they had already done some boating. Can you tell me a little bit more about Francis and about Marjorie and Bester?
I'm afraid that Martin was in contention with Bester Robinson's later on when Martin was on the board. So he didn't have a very good opinion of Bester Robinson, because Bester Robinson was the one who, when he was discussing the possibility of dams in the Grand Canyon, said he couldn't see how it was too bad, because it would be a nice lake where they could take their boats and do water skiing, and there could be a tramway or something to get back up on the plateau. And so he had no big objections to the fact that these two dams were planned in the Grand Canyon.
And that was true for, I think, Echo Park. There were two dams there proposed, and he thought one of those dams would be okay.
Oh, yes. No, there was no objection.
Okay.
With a lot of people, it was hard to convince. But anyway, Martin's opinion of Bester Robinson was very low.
Okay. Understood. And then the Farquhars, what else do you remember about them?
Well, that was the only time I met them. Martin, of course, was in contact with Francis Farquhar later on when he was on the board.
Okay.
And I don't remember that he had any objections to Farquhar. And I never saw Marjorie again. Now, they had two teenagers who came along on that trip, and I think the Robinsons had their kids on their trip, too, on the Yampa.
Okay.
But no, I'm afraid I didn't have any more association with Marjorie Farquhar except that very delightful time when she was so gracious to say, well, you don't have to camp by yourself, come on with us.
And then I think...
At that time, Phil Berry was a teenager.
Okay.
And he was rowing a small raft.
Do you remember Bus Hatch?
Oh, yes, very well.
What do you remember about Bus?
Well, he was... And Don Hatch was just a teenager at that time.
Okay.
But I remember Bus because we brought that raft for him. And Martin had more association with Buzz Hatch than I did, but I remember he was a very pleasant man. And he lived in Vernal, and he ran the Yampa for people. You know, he had a commercial thing.
Uh-huh.
And I think he also ran the Grand Canyon. I'm not sure.
He did run the Grand Canyon some, and that's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. Okay. All right. Anybody else on that trip that rings a bell?
I can't remember the names. I'd have to look on an old Sierra Club bulletin to see the names of the board members, because, as I say, there were a lot of the board members. I think all of the board members. There were two brothers who were along, and there was one man who was a physics professor at UC Cal, and some of the wives came along. But the Farquhar stand out, and the Vesta Robinson especially.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, once again, we've been yik-yakking here for about an hour, and this is great.
And nobody's come to take my temperature.
Good.
I'm not stringing this out too long, but there were quite a few things that were going along, and Martin was building up practically a catalog of small one-page or two-page articles that were printed in the Los Angeles Times, usually on a Sunday. And so many of his articles had to do with the Grand Canyon and dinosaur and other conservation issues, in addition to things about the steam engines and the power plant. And he did all kinds of assorted articles for which he did the photography and the text, and he was paid a few dollars for the text and the pictures, which helped a lot.
All the while, he was still working in the circulation department.
Yes, absolutely. He never got out of it. And when he was, maybe I'm going too far, but anyway, when he was approached by Sunset, he went to the managing editor and said, "I have a proposition of another job, but I'd like to stay here. I'd like to be your conservation editor."
Hmm.
And the managing editor turned him down completely. He said, "No, we don't want that."
Huh.
So that was the turning point there, and that was in 1954.
Okay.
Do you want me to go on with how he got the interview with Sunset?
I do, but let's do it on the next interview.
Okay. I don't know if you've read any of the other articles Martin did at the Times.
Tell me about them.
Well, he did one about the Grand Canyon, because we hiked down at Toro Weep. We went out to the Grand Canyon Monument.
Right. So, Esther, I'll want to know a lot about that. So, so maybe now is it...
horrible.
Well, and I'll want to know about Riffy and Lefty Bryant and all of that. But maybe we've been at this an hour. Let's wrap up this part three, and we'll pick up 1954 with Sunset and the Grand Canyon.
We're not getting very far. This is 2020.
Yeah, I know, but we started in 1919, and it's 1954. We're zipping right along.
Okay. As it gets closer to 2020, I lose track of the years. So you might as well ask me while I still remember some of the years.
Well, this is great, because what I'm really interested in is just what you're going over. So so this is perfect. And with that, I think we'll call it a close to part three oral history interview with Esther Litton. Today is Sunday. It's May 24th, 2020. My name is Tom Martin. Esther, thank you so very much.
Well, you're very welcome. I hope I'm not stringing it out too long.
Not at all. All right, hang on a second.
Well, it's reminding me of lots of things, so.
Good.